Buddha, to Dharma, which is the Sangha. Precept, do only good. I'll just read this a bit. This is a real, this precept, the way she talks about this precept here, is a turning point in the history of our Sangha here. A true turning point in the history of our Sangha. Reverend Master had never said anything like this before that I remember at all. Within me I know this is the right move, for it grows lighter. That's the referring to the way she's meditating on the precepts now. As I meditate, lying here each day, I take a different precept, and I ask that which is to teach me its meaning. Do only good comes next. The Dharma of Shakyamuni Buddha's enlightenment is the Dharma of all existence. That's the Dogen commentary on that precept. Her master goes on to say, do not do anything unless it is good. She puts a little print, single parenthesis around good. Do not do anything unless I have first asked the Lord of the house if it is good for me to do it. Do nothing whatsoever in a hurry. Do nothing whatsoever on the spur of the moment, unless I know the certainty given by the Lord of the house. Know that I must take the consequences of what I do if it is not a fully digested act, for I know what lies beyond good and evil, right and wrong. I know that which lies beyond morality. I know the Lord of the house. Ask the Lord of the house at all times before I do anything whatsoever. Is it good? Is it your will? If I do not ask the Lord of the house builder of the house of ego will again pick up his tools, and before I know it, there will be a great structure in which I must again escape. If a thing is good in this way, again, parentheses around good, it may be done. If it is not good in this way, it should not be done. I am not speaking here of good and evil. I am speaking of good in the sense of if it is right, this is beyond right and wrong. If it is good, it is beyond good and evil. This teaching is indeed the teaching of Shakyamuni Buddha's enlightenment, for there was not one of his acts that was not the result of fully digested perceptual truth. If I live thus, doing that only which is good, after I have asked the Lord of the house, after I know the true Lord of the house, then I can know the teaching of Shakyamuni Buddha's enlightenment and know that his enlightenment and mine are identically the same. But this is only if I know who the Lord of the house is. Is and do not suffer from the idea that I am the Lord of the house. Get this. Now, get this. Always I must ask the Lord of the house. Always I must be humble in his presence. Please teach me that which is good for me to do this day. Please show me that which is good for me to teach this day. Please give me the certainty that I teach the truth and know indeed that when the still small voice within my heart, mind and heart says yes, I must obey that teaching. When it says no, I must not disobey that teaching. When the Lord speaks, spring up joyfully to answer. Then indeed it is good to do anything whatsoever. Know that the Lord will never break the precepts. There were, in River Master's teaching before this point, there were all kinds of intimations of this, what she's teaching here. But it never came out in anything like this depth and clarity all together at once. It's like this incredible burst of it's more than spiritual certainty. It's just clear insight into the very depths of her own being, the very depths of existence. Remember I said in the earlier stages of this retreat that Rim Master was in, how her whole being was crying for help. Here you see what it leads to. She has learned what it is to ask. She has learned what it is to ask with her whole heart. And she is saying here, I'm never going to forsake this now. I have found the way. I'm not going to forsake it. Again, I never heard Rebbe Masser speak of asking like this, anything like it, before 76. Doesn't mean her teaching wasn't profound and wonderful. It was. And this is the teaching of someone who's been knocked out of the driver's seat. Completely. And this is why, I mean, it's magnificent. Always I must ask the Lord of the house. Always I must be humble in His presence. Some people, by the way, object to the His, the Lord, the masculine. Well, think of it as feminine if you want. It doesn't matter to the eternal. In some texts, it's called things like the Imperial Mother. You know, it doesn't matter. For Rebbe Masser, it was this at this time. You know, one of the most traditional Soto Zen ways of speaking, maybe the most traditional Soto Zen way of speaking of the Eternal, the Lord of the house. But don't get lost in the external form of it. Doesn't matter. There is that which is greater than ourselves. Our heart cries out to it in our out of our deepest need. And from that point, we begin to get reprogrammed, as it were. Oh, that bad word, isn't it? We start a new level of education as to what the spiritual life truly is. You know, when you're right at death's door, you know, you can't afford to mess around with the theories of things. You need reality. Before I go on, I want to say a few words about asking. Now, I've said some of these things before, and you know, this is from someone who has at times had real difficulty with knowing what it really meant to ask. What it really meant to ask. Some people find it much easier than others. Some people like me, for a while, tended to get stuck on a kind of formula about it. And then maybe in reaction to that, I kind of backed off from even trying it and just tried to stumble through things as best I could on my instincts. And certainly, there's nothing wrong with that. But it's not until the retreat 98-99 that I felt the need so intensely for such a period of time that it really started within myself getting called out, that just cry, pure cry of the heart. It was just going night and day. And it's at that point that I really began to get re-educated on what it is to really ask for help. I think at times I've been discouraged that I'd asked before and I'd not get any kind of recognizable response. And I have to say that's the case most of the time still. The difference is I'm not looking anymore for a response. I'm not expecting anything. I know that it's enough for me just to ask in my need. And I know also, and I don't know it all the time. When I don't remember it, I make mistakes. I get in trouble. When I remember it, I know that I am never away from that need. That I always have that need. And that whenever I think I know what I'm doing is when I'm in most danger. If I know that I don't know what I'm doing, then I remember. Well, if you don't know, of course, ask. And as long as I just ask with an open heart and don't worry about how the answer is going to come, now I know. You know, there's this lovely line in the Guardian Ceremony. Whenever we pray, we receive without fail a sympathetic response. Now I know that's true. Now I know that's true. Been proved true again and again. So I don't have to worry about how the response comes. Sometimes it will come with a clear response that I can easily recognize and immediately recognize? Most of the time, not. Most of the time, I'm still just, I've asked and I'm just bumbling along. And if I now know that if I remembered to ask, even the bumbling's going to be on track. Even where it seems off track, it's still going to be basically on track. Whereas when I forget to ask, even if it seems on track, it's somehow going to be off track. Maybe for some people this isn't just a lifelong education. For me, it certainly is a lifelong education. We never cease to be a fallible human being. And as fallible, the greatest Zen master is as fallible as any other human being. No one leaves their humanity behind. Another point that is really helpful to bear in mind is that same principle of asking applies to the previous precept. This is one of the places I really learned in 98-99 about the nature of the need, of my need, was I was really asking a lot of the time, you know, please help me to stay on course in the midst of these winds that are, because the karma, you know, at the time it's coming up for cleansing, it can be so powerful when it first hits you in these waves. Really, you know, on hands and knees, praying, please help me to stand fast through these waves as they hit. And then as you stand fast, as you hold on to the eternal for dear life, then eventually the cause reveals itself and there's this great movement of the water of the Spirit to help that particular jangle of karma. But it's not done in some kind of remote detachment. It's done right in the midst of the difficulties that are. So the intensity of the pure feeling, it's the karma coming due, karmic consequence being reaped. So it applies as much to cease from evil as to any other precept. In the cease from evil precept, Reverend Master is emphasizing her resolve to cease from evil. In this one, the do only good, she's emphasizing, you know, I can't truly do good in the true sense, in the true spiritual sense, unless I'm asking. And for myself, I would say, and for myself, with regard to the cease from evil, I can't truly cease from evil unless I'm asking. Always our first responsibility, or I should maybe just speak for myself. For myself, I know now my first responsibility always is to turn towards the eternal. Which is the same as Reverend Master Mokshin has pointed out recently in something she's written. You know, following is just turning towards our own true heart. That's our responsibility. Another thing I'd like to say about the asking here is that where there is doubt about oneself, there will be doubt about asking if one does it. Now, the asking really exposes self-doubt. You know, where there is a sense of unworthiness, there will be that self-doubt and that doubt about the asking. Can someone as unworthy as me really hear the voice of the eternal? The answer is, forget about that. just when it's good to ask, and don't worry about whether you can hear or not. Just trust. Don't worry about whether you can hear or not. A person can get so frustrated with, I don't think I can hear. I can't tell the difference between my voice, the voice of my ego, and the voice of my karma, and the voice of the eternal. I can't tell the difference. They get so frustrated, they just say, out of hell with the whole thing. There's nothing to it. There is something to it. There's everything to it. And one cannot bring a prideful attitude to this process. One has to bring a humble and open heart to this process. And self-judgment is a form of pride. Self-doubt is a form of pride. Who am I that I should judge anyone, including myself? You know, the first step in religion is always to get out of God's seat. Who am I to put conditions on the eternal or on myself or on my own capacities unless I get a clear response? There's no point in the asking. You know, that's blackmail if you carry it very far. You know, I won't ask if you don't answer. The answer to that is if it is good, when it is good, ask. And leave the results in the hands of the eternal. This is also exactly the way one should ask of one's master. The master is not under any obligation to give you a response in your time frame or in your way. But every true question is heard by a true master. I should say every true question from a true disciple is heard by a true master. And you may or may not get a response that you recognize. This is why we have to have so much faith. Not demanding, not expectation, faith. Above all, don't look down. One can only ask truly if one is looking up spiritually. Now, don't go around with your nose in the air, with your eyes up pointed at the sky. You know, you step on a rake and get whacked, you know. But our heart needs to be looking up. And when you truly meditate, your heart does look up. When the heart is looking up, then it is natural for it to cry out to the eternal. It is natural for it to bow to the eternal, to give gratitude. Right in the midst of an ordinary daily life. We don't have to restructure daily life in some elaborate way to make these things happen. And it's again driver seat-y. We just have to do our training and trust. Do our training and trust. I want to say a few words about the difference between the worldly understanding of good and evil and this, if it is good, if it is right. Reverend Master used to sit there and she'd hold her hand like there was, like she was holding like a ball or something in her hand, and she'd say, it's light, not heavy. And she'd raise and lower her hand as if she's holding something very light and buoyant in it, kind of bouncing it in her hand. She'd say, it's light, it's not heavy. The if it is good has this quality of lightness to it. If it is good, you go in there with no expectations. Okay, what is good to do here? I don't know what to do. What is this good to do? And you pose the question. Initially, one may pose it to oneself. But eventually, as one sits with it, one poses it to the eternal. What is it that's good to do? And then you, like, put it on the altar. make the offering of the question, place it upon the altar. What is it good to do? I'm willing to do that which is good, but I don't know what it is it's good to do. Here, you know, worldly ideas of right and wrong get thrown out the window. Think of the way the world views right and wrong. And you see why it has to go out the window. The worldly view of right and wrong is a kind of formula. Whatever the particular formula is, and it varies from culture to culture and society to society. One society says it's good to put people in prison and not execute them. Another society says that if a person commits adultery, you stone them to death. You know, one society says it's good not to use drugs. Another society says, use the drugs. You know, they're wonderful. And anyone who studies a little bit of anthropology knows this. So obviously, in that, if you're just talking about socially accepted views of good and evil, what you just have is relativism, really. And formula that has, in some areas, maybe a relationship to the precepts, and others very non-perceptual. The precepts come from a deeper place. The precepts come from that place in us which recognizes the workings of the law of karma, the deep truth of the way karma works, and which recognizes, especially at the deepest instinctive level, what it is to go against the heart. What it is to go against the heart. The precepts are saying, if you avoid these particular things, they'll help you follow your heart. But the true spirit of the precept is the spirit of harmonizing with the eternal and following the eternal, wherever the eternal leads. And the eternal will not lead to the breaking of the true spirit of the precepts. How a person's actions may mesh with the socially accepted views of right and wrong is always an open question for contemplatives. And in every society in which there has been a manifestation of true deep contemplative practice, it's always been a problem for the contemplatives. One of the rationalizations, at least, of an intense persecution of the Buddhists, and there were a couple of short, very, very intense persecutions of Buddhists in the Tang Dynasty in China. But one of the, I think it was the Tang Dynasty, but anyway, one of the rationalizations given was that the celibacy was a totally anti-Chinese practice and went against the social good, and that, you know, renunciation of the world and the cutting of family ties, that's pretty inconceivable to the oriental mind, especially in China. So from that point of view, you know, the actions of Buddhist, very sincere Buddhist monks could be viewed as being immoral, and was viewed in that way. More recently, a number of years ago, Rinmaster Koten found an article by a Western journalist on the attitudes of Cambodian people after the kind of horrors of the Khmer Rouge, and after a couple million of the Cambodian people had been murdered by some of their own people. This journalist was in Cambodia and found that some of these people who'd done the murdering and the torturing and the like were living right among the people they'd murdered and tortured, the families, people they murdered and tortured, and being treated with kindness. And this journalist was outraged that these Buddhist people would treat these people with such forgiveness and kindness. And when he asked about it, it was explained, well, these people who'd done these wicked things had made terrible karma for themselves, and so they were to be pitied and treated with kindness, not judged and punished. But in this society, in our society, such behavior would be viewed as being morally weak and by some people unforgivable and criminal itself. Because we have a very strong belief in our culture among many, many people that punishment is good, that you must do punishment, and that if you don't punish perpetrators, the victims will never know peace. It seems absurd to say something like that, doesn't it? That's a belief you see all the time, expressed all the time. That there will be no closure for the victims until the perpetrators are punished. Whereas in actual fact, exactly the reverse tends to be true. People who long for vengeance have no peace till they give up the vengeance. That's the truth. The if it is right, they point us toward the true spirit of the precepts. And it's not an accident that they occur here with the strong emphasis on asking. Where are you going to find out what's good? Where are you going to find out what's right? Are you going to replace the worldly formula with a Buddhist religious formula? No, that won't work. The precepts themselves are not a formula. They're a help, but they're not a formula. The rules of a monastic order are not a formula that can be used. Daily life situations are too particular and too unique. I find this all the time. You've never seen it all. You know, as a teacher, I'm always being faced with some situation with someone that I have no precedent for. How do I proceed? Well, start by turning towards the eternal and asking and meditating with it. Meditate with it. Ask. Sit still. Make the offering from the heart. Be willing. Be patient. Listen. So, Rim Master says, do nothing whatsoever in a hurry. Do nothing whatsoever on the spur of the moment. When I talk about the precepts and River Master's precepts commentary, it's always this particular one I come back to again and again. And this again, this blossomed in 1976 in the midst of our Sangha as the most amazing manifestation of deep teaching. You know, the foundations had been laid, but this took it to a whole nother level. And each of us who is following in River Master's footsteps, well, we are this is our birthright of teaching here. This is our birthright of teaching. It asks a lot of us. It asks a lot. And it expresses a tremendous faith in the capacity of every human being to actually hear and follow their heart. And what it expresses as being possible actually is possible. No one gets it right all the time. Don't worry about that. Don't worry about the not getting it right all the time. No one does. Now I want to remind people finally that there's always a default position that you can go to when you start to get confused. In 1998, 99, I was calling it the zero reset button. I was thinking of those, like on a dashboard of a car, you know, where you, some cars you'll have a little button, you can push the little thing to go back to zero for your mileage for a particular trip or between gas fill-ups or however you want to use it. I was thinking of that little button, you push it and it goes back to zero. And for me at that time, you know, that zero reset button is simply, you know, I don't know anything. I don't need to know anything. I don't really have anything. I don't need to have anything. I don't have to cling to anything. Zero reset. When I can't know anything else to do, what can I do? If a person who doesn't have anything, a person who doesn't know anything, a person who's not clinging to anything, what can they possibly do? Well, they may not be able to do anything else. They may not know anything else, but they can always just sit still. Just go inside themselves and sit still. There's zero reset. Pure meditation. Zero reset. You don't need to be someone who desperately cries out to the eternal. Because you end up desperately crying out, your crying will be so loud that you won't hear. This takes place in the context of meditation. When it's good to do so, one asks. When it's good to do so, one simply sits still and listens. When it's good to do so, one follows, one acts. And again, it throws you back, and well, how do you know what's good? You can always start with that zero reset. Just meditate a bit. Buddha, Sangha.